Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the EPA has proposed new rules limiting carbon emissions. And the outcry from the industry, lost jobs, higher energy costs, was completely predictable. But people concerned about climate change aren't exactly dancing in the aisles either. So, are the new rules a bold step forward fighting climate change, or something much less? We'll hear from Janet Redmond of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. Also this week, New York Times reporter James Risen faces incarceration for citing the reporter's privilege to protect a source and refusing to testify in a criminal case against an ex-CIA employee. The Supreme Court refused to take his case on June 2nd and effectively let stand a lower court ruling finding there is no such thing as a reporter's privilege. We'll talk to Trevor Timm of the Freedom of the Press Foundation about the ruling. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
The prisoner swap that freed U.S. Army Sergeant Bo Bergdahl has attracted an enormous amount of controversy. There's a lot of silly partisanship involved here, but one area of concern is that the five Taliban prisoners who were freed from Guantanamo for Bergdahl will return to the battlefield. It's a claim that deserves some unpacking. As the Wall Street Journal reported, quote, by January 2014, about 29% of 614 detainees released from the prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, had returned to violence, according to the Director of National Intelligence, close quote. And on the Fox News Channel, reporter Catherine Herridge declared,
since 2008, the number of detainees confirmed or suspected of returning to the battlefield has climbed to nearly one in three.
Now, neither of these reports are accurate. The U.S. government report lists 16.9% of the freed detainees as having been confirmed of reengaging in violence. The 29% figure includes those suspected of reengaging, a category that describes plausible but unverified or single-source reporting. In any case, this is a very low rate of recidivism, perhaps due to the fact that many Guantanamo prisoners were not engaged in any sort of terrorism in the first place, something to remember when you read about them returning to the battlefield. What's more, the rate at which former prisoners engage in terrorism or violence has been falling dramatically since January 2009, according to these same U.S. government figures, down to about 6% since January of 2009. It has not, as Fox is reporting here, been climbing.
What is Edward Snowden's crime? That was basically the debate held on the June 1st episode of NBC's Meet the Press. Guest Newt Gingrich said Snowden was a traitor who ended up aiding and abetting the enemy. On the other side of the debate was hawkish former Democratic Representative Jane Harman, who said labeling the NSA whistleblower a traitor before he's convicted was unfair, but then offered a view not far removed from Gingrich's, saying that Snowden wasn't a whistleblower and had leaked our technology playbook, and that really compromises us. Host David Gregory then played tape of Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel saying Snowden had indisputably damaged the security of the United States. Gingrich echoed Hagel, saying Snowden threatens the very fabric of our national security. Harman offered a variation arguing that Snowden should cut a deal and serve prison time. The Meet the Press debate came on the heels of a nightly news report in which Brian Williams seemed defensive about having landed an exclusive interview with Snowden earlier. Responding to criticism of that interview, Williams described Snowden like this.
Many regard him as a treasonist and traitor who should pay dearly for what he's done, and many fiercely believe he has done grave damage to the United States. Some of our viewers have let us know they are outraged that we have interviewed him at all.
That segment included a lengthy denunciation of Snowden from Secretary of State John Kerry, followed by a report from correspondent Chuck Todd, who confirmed that, yes, indeed, government officials really, really don't like Snowden. It's not political theater, Todd explained. It's real rage. NBC has been labeling its Snowden coverage traitor or patriot. For reports like these, traitor or criminal might be more appropriate.
Back in April, the New York Times had a big scoop, photographic proof that the pro-Russian separatist fighters in Ukraine were actually Russian agents. The scoop quickly fizzled out, though. But the Times is still trying really hard to make this case, even when reality doesn't seem to help much. The latest evidence, Russians revealed among Ukraine fighters, read one May 28th headline, which quickly pointed out that the Russian claims that none of these men are soldiers are correct, since there's no evidence that they are. But the Times reports, quote, motley assortments of fighters from other war zones that are intimately associated with Russia would be unlikely to surface against the powerful will of the Russian President Vladimir Putin, experts said, close quote. This, readers are told, raises new questions about Russian involvement, and it all, quote, raises the possibility of a more subtle Russian game, close quote. So then on June 1st, the Times ran a long piece headlined, In Ukraine War, Kremlin Leaves No Fingerprints, which was boiled down to the idea that in eastern Ukraine, quote, Russian freelancers shape events and the Kremlin plausibly denies involvement, close quote. It's sort of Kremlinology, New York Times style. There isn't strong, direct evidence for what they're trying to claim about the level of Russian involvement in Ukraine, but somehow the absence of this evidence serves as proof that Russia is up to something.
Pundits relentlessly try to push liberal Democrats to the right while singing the praises of conservative Democrats whom they routinely and inaccurately misidentify as moderate and centrist. Take New York Times columnist Frank Bruni. On June 2nd, he cheered Democratic New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, who has been performing a balancing act with implications for Democratic politics well beyond the state. Writes Bruni, Cuomo, quote, speaks to a perennial challenge in both parties. How does a pragmatic politician steer the kind of centrist course that often works best in the long run without provoking a revolt from the more partisan warriors in his or her camp, close quote. Bruni quotes a Democratic insider who says Cuomo, quote, likes to live in the middle. That's where the country is, close quote. Bruni notes that Cuomo does favor so-called social issues like marriage equality and gun control, which are highly popular centrist policies. But he portrays Cuomo as centrist, as moderate on economic issues because he opposed minimum wage increases, cut corporate taxes, and famously rejected a plan to raise taxes on New York City's wealthiest. These positions are anything but popular or centrist. The public generally, and particularly Democrats, support higher minimum wages and increased taxes on the wealthy and corporations. So Cuomo's not in the center on those issues. Nonetheless, Bruni worries that other Democrats might tug Cuomo away from his middle and hijack his legacy. He notes the prospect of a left too potent clearly chills Cuomo. Cuomo's not the only one.
And finally, CNN Films will debut a documentary about George H.W. Bush, 41 on 41, on June 15th. The film will feature 41 sources, described by the television industry publication The Wrap as those who have known the elder Bush the best. Among them, his wife Barbara Bush, Presidents Clinton and Obama, Vice President Dan Quayle, Colin Powell, and so on. One of the film's executive producers is a former Bush speechwriter, so don't expect a critical look at the former president. But there's another hitch, which perhaps explains the imbalance. The documentary is funded by the George Bush Presidential Library Foundation. Now, this is a yawning ethical breach, especially when one considers that just last year, CNN yanked a Hillary Clinton documentary after Republicans complained it would be unfair publicity for a possible presidential candidate. Unlike the Bush film, the Clinton film was not funded by Clinton supporters. The Wrap doesn't quote CNN on this conflict, but they do quote a very pleased-sounding Fred McClure, the CEO of Bush's Presidential Library, who says the film will be, quote, an engaging and uplifting profile of one of our greatest citizens that no American will want to miss, close quote. To be sure.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group, FAIR.
In Environmental groups call it a historic move. Industry groups have called it a job killer that will increase the price of energy. That was the thumbnail description ABC's Diane Sawyer provided viewers about the proposed new rules from the EPA to limit carbon emissions. Elsewhere in the media, the new carbon rules are presented both as a historic step in the fight against climate change and as far, far too timid to actually have much impact. Which is right, or could both be? Janet Redman is director of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies and a founding participant in the Global Climate Justice Now Network. Welcome to Counterspin, Janet Redman.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Now, it's possible for policy to be good and leading to less pollution and yet not be good enough. Is that what we have here with these proposed new EPA rules?
Yeah, that's exactly right. This is a historic act. This is the first time that carbon dioxide pollution, greenhouse gas emissions, are going to be regulated from existing power plants. But as you mentioned, it's not good enough to make the U.S. a leader on the global stage. In 2009, as folks might remember, the EPA determined that greenhouse gas pollution is in fact a threat to Americans' well-being because it leads to climate change, and climate change has negative impacts on families, residents, and on their environment. So under the Clean Air Act, the EPA does in fact have the role of regulating greenhouse gas pollutions. And that's a really important and critical step that the EPA has decided to go ahead and do that, in part because it's an environmental justice issue. So if we look at greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, we see that climate change impacts disproportionately affect people living in communities of color and low-income communities. And of course, pollution coming from existing power plants disproportionately impacts communities of color and people living in poverty. So cleaning up greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power plants is in some ways a win on both fronts. It's good for the climate and it's good for people. The problem is these emissions targets that the EPA has set are not high enough. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the body of 200-plus scientists who look over the science around the planet, have told us that developed countries like the United States need to reduce our emissions between 25 and 40% from 1990 levels by the year 2020. That's from our entire economy. Unfortunately, the EPA's rules only count toward 40% of our emissions, so that's just the power-generating sector. Mm-hmm. And they're using the baseline of 2005. So basically, it's like using Thanksgiving as the baseline for a diet. It's saying we're going to use a year that has a lot more emissions than the year that the rest of the world uses. So it's going to look like we're cutting our emissions, but we're actually starting from a different point from everyone else. So the emissions that the EPA is talking about, the cuts that they've set out as their target, are actually somewhere between no reductions from 1990 levels and about 7% reductions from 1990 levels, a far cry from the 40% that we should be on the hook for.
And I've seen people say that the 30% level, you know, in this narrow window, we're already halfway there anyway without any proposals from the EPA, so it does seem like it's a rather timid step. One of the big controversies around all of this is the coal industry. You would think, from the sound of it, that we would be talking about reducing coal in the U.S. energy mix. But it seems like the EPA is making it very clear in the projections going off into the future that coal is still going to be a very large part of U.S. energy production domestically.
That's right. I mean, what we see from the EPA's guidelines for this rule moving forward is they're using the word flexibility a lot and this idea of an all-of-the-above solution. That should kind of put an alarm in our head. That's kind of like Obama's all-of-the-above energy plan, which says nothing is off the table. There's nothing off the table in this mix, not coal, not nuclear energy, and nothing in between. So that flexibility does two things. One, it allows the EPA to set state targets. So while we've got this 30% target by 2030, it's actually made up of individual state targets for energy intensity, so not even for absolute greenhouse gas reductions, for making the energy produced be less emitting per megawatt, for example. And so it says that, you know, every state can figure out how they want to get to their target on their own. There are lots of different tools they can use. They can use renewable energy portfolio standards. They can use demand-side energy efficiency measures like, you know, more efficient appliances, et cetera. They can also use cap-and-trade programs. But one of the pieces that's most worrying and was picked up in The Guardian today is that some of the states aren't really having to reduce their emissions at all, particularly the dirtiest states, the coal-producing states. So while the coal industry and the fossil fuel industry is crying you know, a foul, there's actually less to worry about than there should be in terms of reducing the use of the dirtiest energies like coal.
As the EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy was on the PBS NewsHour saying, no, states are going to have this flexibility to protect the coal industry. So it doesn't seem like this fits into the whole quote-unquote war on coal. There's a lot of talk about how this is going to project internationally. Obama needed to show leadership on this issue. Other countries, particularly China, perhaps India, are going to take this as a signal as we move forward in global climate negotiations. Is this really the sort of move that's going to inspire other countries to act?
It's a good question. I'm not sure that other countries will be inspired. I think what we're seeing is kind of a chessboard or a timeline. So this year there will be a climate summit at the UN General Assembly that Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, has called. And it's really an occasion. He's made it an occasion for country leaders to put something on the table. So heads of state are being asked to arrive there to kind of make announcements outside of the negotiating forum. And so I really see this as part of the U.S.'s play to kind of be able to arrive there and put something on the table when realistically it's nothing more. In fact, it's less than what they promised they would do back in 2009 when they were talking about the next decade. What's interesting is that the day after the U.S. announced the EPA's greenhouse gas emission reductions from coal-fired power plants, China came forward and said they were going to limit their greenhouse gas emissions as well. So some people have lauded this and said, look, see, the U.S. is a leader. In fact, they've pushed China. You know, realistically, the U.S. and China are in conversation. In some ways, it's beneficial for both of those countries to say, hey, we're doing something serious. So my concern is actually more that countries will, you know, basically allow U.S. and China to get away with some really lax greenhouse gas emissions targets, which won't get us globally to where we need to be to really protect people and the planet.
Now, staying on this global issue, I know you've written recently about initiatives from the White House and Congress aimed at increasing electricity production in Africa, something they're calling Power Africa, $7 billion to the energy sector. Tell us how this fits in with the climate change discussion, what your concerns are about this, because it sounds and is portrayed anyway as a positive, almost altruistic policy idea. Let's bring power to places that don't have it.
There's no family on the planet that should not have access to reliable modern energy. It is critical for folks in Africa to be able to study at night, for women to be able to walk home safely on lit pathways. So the question that we have to look at is what's the broader context? What the U.S. is doing through Power Africa in some ways is directing our overseas private investment corporation. Again, our overseas private investment corporation guarantees loans to U.S. companies who are investing in other countries. So, for example, we're going to be seeing our tax dollars supporting investment by U.S. corporations in expansion of fossil fuel industry, in particular the natural gas industry, in African countries for large-scale projects that will largely go to industrial centers or will be used for energy export. What we'd like to see instead is money, U.S. money, going to small, medium enterprises, African-owned enterprises that are actually bringing renewable energy access to families in Africa, particularly rural families who have been off the grid completely until this point.
We've been speaking with Janet Redman of the Climate Policy Program at the Institute for Policy Studies. Her article, EPA's Carbon Rule Falls Short of Real Emissions Reduction, co-authored with Renata Howder, can be found at ips-dc.org. Janet Redman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks so much for having me on.
When the Supreme Court refused to hear the case of New York Times reporter James Risen, it let stand a lower court decision that says that Risen must testify in the criminal trial of former CIA official Jeffrey Sterling or face possible incarceration. Sterling is suspected of giving information to Risen about a CIA operation to disrupt Iran's supposed nuclear weapons program. The case is understandably shaping up as a major freedom of the press story with disturbing ramifications for the future of journalism. With us to talk about this is Trevor Timm. He's the co-founder and director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. Trevor Timm, it's good to have you back on Counterspin.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
Well, so not good news for journalism. What's the worst of it?
No, it's certainly not good news for journalism. You know, this case actually started out as promising for national security reporting. In the lower court, a judge ruled actually twice, both in the grand jury and the trial, that James Risen qualified for a common law reporter's privilege, meaning that he was able to keep his source confidential and wouldn't have had to testify at the leaked trial of Jeffrey Sterling. But the Fourth Circuit earlier this year came down with just a awful ruling for press freedom, not only ruling that, that James Risen didn't apply for the common law reporter's privilege, but saying that, that the privilege did not exist at all. And this was James Risen's last appeal to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court unfortunately refused to hear his case, which means now that everybody, all the reporters working in the Fourth Circuit, which includes areas of Virginia where untold number of national security sources work and where national security journalists often write their stories, will have no protection. And, you know, news gathering and protecting sources is a vital part of journalism. And this could lead to more subpoenas for reporters. And if they refuse to comply, reporters ending up in prison.
Well, I think it bears repeating. You're saying that in the district where the most important, some of the most important journalism takes place, monitoring the national security state, there's no reporter's privilege anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. When you look at all of the leak cases that have come out in the past 6 or 8 years, almost all of them have been in the Fourth Circuit. And so if the government decides to call witnesses from now on, these journalists will have the least protection they would have anywhere else in the country. And unfortunately, it's the spot of the country where they are most active and are at most risk.
The threat here is on several levels. Not least is how sources might dummy up rather than talk to reporters who can no longer protect them. You know, the ultimate casualty really being the public's right to know.
Absolutely. The real losers here are definitely the public. You know, we've seen a real chill of investigative journalism over the past few years because of this record crackdown on whistleblowers. And part of the way that journalists get sources to open up to them is by guaranteeing their anonymity. And journalists can certainly still do that, and they can certainly still refuse to testify. They just may now, unfortunately, end up in jail a lot easier because of this Fourth Circuit ruling, and because the Supreme Court refused to hear the case, they're effectively sanctioning the Fourth Circuit ruling. Now, it bears noting that it's possible if the Supreme Court took up this case that James Risen could have lost again, and that actually could have been even worse for press freedom, because that means that the case would have been applicable across the entire country. But, you know, I think that might be going a step too far in speculating about what the Supreme Court could have ruled. But this certainly was a step back for press freedom, no matter how you look at it.
I want to get back to the specific of Risen's case. What was the important story he was trying to tell here that merits a reporter's privilege?
Well, we have to remember that this case dates back to the Bush administration, and James Risen was one of two reporters that broke the NSA warrantless wiretapping story in 2005 and 2006, which ended up winning a Pulitzer Prize and ended up sparking a grand jury investigation of its own. But that's actually not what James Risen was ultimately subpoenaed for. A lot of people think that the government chose to go after him for another story he did because it was less in the public's eye, and actually not actually published in the New York Times, but published in a book that James Risen wrote called State of War in 2006, just an unbelievably fascinating book that looked at a lot of the intel failures that happened during the Bush administration, along with the incredible constitutional overreach that we're so familiar with today. But the chapter in question is about this colossal mistake the CIA made in the 1990s, where they actually inadvertently handed over blueprints to a nuclear bomb to Iran at the time that they were trying to actually prevent them from getting those exact documents. And it's just an amazing tale of intelligence gone wrong. And, of course, it's a vital public interest for people to realize what intelligence agencies are doing behind closed doors, especially when they make such colossal mistakes. And, unfortunately, the government has decided to continue to pursue Risen to not only subpoena him, but they have also reportedly gotten his phone records, his email records, his phone records, and have really been harassing him for years at this point.
Trevor Tim, I was chilled by a quote about reporter sources in your piece about Risen. You wrote, out of the 8 source prosecutions under the Obama administration, the Sterling case is the only one where a reporter was called to testify. As an unnamed national security official reportedly said a year ago, quote, the Risen subpoena is one of the last you'll see. We don't need to ask who you're talking to. We know. Close quote. If true, the problem is bigger than just the threat against reporters' privilege. It's a threat to the concept of independent journalism. What can be done here?
Absolutely. As damaging and worrying as the Risen case is, it is actually kind of an anomaly. The government's figured out in many of these cases that they actually don't need reporters to testify, because a lot of times reporters and sources communicate via email and phone calls, which those records are located with third parties. Email and phone call providers, who the government can go to and subpoena in secret without the journalist or the source knowing, get this information, and use it to prosecute the sources. And before anybody finds out, it's too late, and the information's already in their hands. And so, really, this case is just another indication that journalists and sources need to get more familiar with encryption technology to protect themselves from the first moment they start talking, instead of protecting themselves years later if and when they actually get subpoenaed by a court.
I just want to add, if you'd like to join a coalition, including FAIR, in demanding the administration halt legal action against Mr. Risen and move to protect freedom of the press, you can visit FAIR.org and join our petition. We've been speaking with Trevor Tim, director of the Freedom of the Press Foundation. You can find them at PressFreedomFoundation.org. Thanks again for joining us today on Counterspin, Trevor Tim.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the Media Watch Group FAIR. If you like Counterspin, then please check out Extra, FAIR's monthly magazine. Go to FAIR.org and find out how to subscribe. This show is engineered by Kelly Spivey and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.